The main reason why today is a fast day is because in the second Beis Hamikdash, the siege on Yerushalayim reached its critical stage where the Romans broke through the walls of Yerushalayim and began their advance towards the Beis Hamikdash, and eventually 3 weeks later on Tisha B'Av they burnt and destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. The Mishnah says that there are four other things that happened on this day in history. The first of them, that this is the day that Moshe Rabbeinu descended from Har Sinai 40 days after the Torah was given, and he found the Jewish people serving the golden calf, and he broke the Luchos. So this was the day that the Luchos were broken. Also, according to some, Menashe, the evil king Menashe, put a idol into the Holy of Holies. And at a different point in history, the Torah was burnt, either the special Torah that was in the Beis Hamikdash, or in general, a Greek officer burnt as many Sifrei Torah as he could find. Posthumus burnt the Torah, and also in the second Beis Hamikdash, the daily sacrifices were stopped on Shivasar B'Tammuz, towards the end of towards the destruction of the temple. So these are the five things that happened today. And the Chafetz Chaim says that partially mourning for something, or in fact the reason to mourn, God taking something away from us or threatening to take it away, serves the purpose, or one purpose, of making us more appreciative of what it is that we had. You appreciate something more when it's not there anymore, or when you're in danger of having it taken away. Unfortunately, many people, or most of us, appreciate our parents most when they're not here anymore. And therefore, if Yerushalayim, the walls of Yerushalayim were breached, and that's what we're mourning about, then I think it'd be important to understand a little bit what Yerushalayim's significance is, what's so important about Yerushalayim, and in that way we will fulfill the purpose of the fasting of appreciating what perhaps we didn't appreciate and use properly when we had it, and that's why it was taken away, at least temporarily, from us for the last 2,000 years. And even though we're sitting in Yerushalayim, but what Yerushalayim really is, with a Beis HaMikdash, with its full holiness, has not yet been restored. I'd like to dedicate the shiur in memory of an uncle who passed away on Shavuot B'Tammuz quite a few years ago, Feivel ben Yaakov Moshe. In order to understand the real importance and purpose of Yerushalayim, I want to start with speaking about the purpose of the Jewish people. What is our mission? What are we supposed to accomplish in this world as individuals and as a people? So the Torah tells us very clearly what the mission of the Jewish people is. V'atem tiyuli mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh. You are to be a kingdom of kohanim, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. What does that mean? A kohen is God's representative to the Jewish people. Right? If you want to do something directed towards God, the Kohen is the one you give it to. The Kohen represents God to us, and we represent, and he links us to God. So the Kohen is not an intermediary, but he is God's representative. We, in turn, are God's representatives to the world. We represent God to the world in general. How do we do that? Not by handing out his calling card, I represent God, if you need him, give me a call. But by fulfilling the second phrase, the Goy Kadosh, by being a holy nation, by living a holy existence. What does that mean? So in order to give you an understanding of what that is, let me tell you a chazal that Rashi quotes. Torah says, Vo'avdil eschem min ho'amim li osli. I separated you from the nations of the world to be mine. On that, the rabbis commented, Im atem muvdolim atem shali. If you separate yourselves from the nations of the world, then you're mine. Ve'im lav, and if you don't separate yourself from the nations of the world, hare atem shel Nebuchadnezzar v'chaveirov, then you belong to Nebuchadnezzar and his friends. Now perhaps the simple meaning is that if we don't do the terrible abominations that the nations of the world do, we don't sacrifice our children to strange gods, and we don't eat disgusting things, and we're not immoral, then God will protect us. Then you're mine. But if not, if we do all these terrible things and don't separate ourselves from the way the nations of the world conduct themselves, then God will give us into the hands of our enemy like Nebuchadnezzar. But it doesn't say that. It doesn't say, I'll protect you or I'll hand you into the hands of your enemies. It says, you're mine or you're theirs. And why mention Nebuchadnezzar altogether? We had so many enemies before him and after him. Why single him out? So what I think it means is the following. A non-Jew only has to keep 7 mitzvahs. And if he keeps them properly with the proper intention, then he'll get a share in the world to come. And his 7 mitzvahs are basically to be moral. That's why there's 7, the Maharal says. 7 represents the natural world. A non-Jew has to stay and conform with the natural world, not abuse it, not distort it, not pollute it, and therefore he can't steal or murder or serve idolatry or be immoral or curse God's name or be cruel and take flesh from a living animal. And he has to have a justice, social justice system. If he fulfills that role, he'll get a share in the world to come. Morality. Just to illustrate to you what that means. Not that this story intimates that this is the life that most non-Jews live. No, it's not. I'm trying to illustrate to you that a non-Jew could live this kind of life and still get a share in the world to come. I was once on a plane going from New York to Cleveland. And the plane, instead of taking off, taxied off the runway and just sat there. And 5, 10, 15, 20, it was 45 minutes already, we're just sitting on the side of the runway. Nobody is telling us what's wrong. Why are we sitting there? Why aren't we taking off? And people were starting to get very nervous. So they decided that they didn't want to tell us what was wrong, I don't know why, but they didn't want people to be nervous. So they started to serve free alcoholic drinks. And the Irishman behind me had a few too many of these free alcoholic drinks. And he got very happy, and he started walking around the plane looking for friends of his from Cleveland who had been in New York and were returning to Cleveland. And he brought them and told them to stand around his seat because he wants to tell them a story. Now, at this point, the man was talking so loud that if I was in another plane in the air, I would have heard him. Earplugs would not have helped. And I was sitting right in front of his seat, so all these people were gathered around my seat, and he was telling them this story. So I said, obviously, the Rabbi Nishon wants me to hear this story because there's no way of avoiding it. So I'll pay attention. There's probably something going to be I'm going to learn from this. So this, more or less, is what he said. He told his friends, you know that I've been in a terrible depression. My wife died a few months ago, and I've just been in terrible depression. And a few weeks ago, my son, who is a very wealthy physician in New York, called me, and he said, Dad, you're terribly depressed. It bothers me. I want to get you out of your depression. So I want you to come to New York on my expense. I'll put you up in a 5-star hotel, and I will take you every day to see another sight of New York. You never saw the big city. And maybe that'll take your mind off our mother's death, and you'll get out of your depression. So I took my son up on it, he says. And I came to New York, and my son put me up in this beautiful hotel, and every day he took me to see something else in New York. He said, but last night was the zenith of my trip. Last night, my son took me to one of the 10 most luxurious restaurants in the world that happens to be in New York. And he mentioned the name of the restaurant. I didn't catch the name. It didn't make a difference. I'm sure the kashrus was not up to my standards. And therefore, I don't remember the name of the restaurant. He says, you can't imagine. We went to this restaurant. It was so luxurious. And they sat us down at a table that was fit for King Arthur. Everybody had their own little throne. And then they gave us a menu. I couldn't even read half of the menu. He said, but I noticed that the most expensive thing on the menu was a 7-course meal where the main course was 3-pound steak. Now, you have to understand what that means. In these fast food places, those gigantic hamburgers are 1/4 pound of beef. That means 12 of them is 3 pounds of steak. That's a little cow. So here, and that's not the only thing you eat. That was just one course. There were 7 courses with the main course, this 3 pounds of steak and the side dishes. The man said, I thought to myself, I don't know if I'll ever be in a restaurant like this again in my life. My son can afford it. I'm going for the top of the menu. So I ordered the 7-course, 3-pound steak meal. They served it from soup to nuts. I finished everything. When I finished the meal, I see there's 2 distinguished gentlemen standing at the table in tuxedos. And one of them's holding a scroll. And the man with the scroll says to me, I want to introduce myself. I'm the maitre d' of this restaurant. And the man opposite me is the owner of the restaurant. And we want to let you know that you are the 7th person in the history of this restaurant who finished the 3-pound steak meal without asking for a doggy bag, who ate the whole thing. And we have a scroll printed up for this occasion with blanks. We're going to fill your name in and tonight's date, and you're going to have this testimony that you achieved this great feat in our restaurant tonight. They fill in my name in calligraphy, the date, they sign it, and they hand it to me. The man now had tears welling up in his eyes. He said, you have no idea how I felt, right? But that was nothing. After they gave me the scroll, they tell me to look at the wall opposite my table, and I will see 6 bronze plaques with names and dates on them. They tell me these are the names and dates of the people before you that finished the 3-pound, 7-course steak meal in our restaurant. Tomorrow, they said, we are going out and buying another bronze plaque with putting your name in tonight's date, and you will be on the wall of this restaurant for posterity. At that point, I wanted to turn around and ask the guy if there were little bulbs on those bronze plaques, because that would have been a very bad sign to what happened to the 6 people before him who finished the meal. But I kept my mouth shut. And at this point, the man was crying. Mamish crying like a baby. He said, you have no idea how I felt. My name is up on that restaurant wall. I feel fulfilled. I don't know if I have any more purpose to live. Those were exact words. At that point, I started to daven very earnestly that before this plane takes off, someone who's heard the story, and everybody in the plane heard it, stands up and say, I know a restaurant that serves a 4-pound steak meal. What difference did it make to me? I was afraid that in the heavenly court, they heard what he said, and they said, you know what, he's right. He has no more purpose to live. So when the plane takes off, they're going to take him down, and I'm sitting in front of him. I don't know if I could survive. So I was hoping that he'd have a purpose to live, another pound of steak in a different restaurant, right, and he would give him a purpose to live. Now, a non-Jew could live a life where his entire focus, his entire goal in life is to eat 3 pounds of steak in a fancy restaurant. As long as he didn't steal the meat, he didn't kill anybody for it, he didn't curse God because it was too tough, he didn't take it from a living animal, he wasn't immoral and didn't serve idolatry, he'll get a share in the world to come. But if a Jew lives a life like that, he's not going to get a share in the world to come. You know why? Because our mission in this world is different. We can't just be moral. We have to be holy. And therefore, in that holiness, we have to be the place where God's presence devolves in this world. And that's what it says. You should build for me a mikdash v'shachanti bisocham, and I will dwell amongst you. God doesn't dwell in the mikdash. He dwells in the heart of every Jew. We are God's temple. We are the place where God's presence is obvious in this world because of the lifestyle that we live, a holy lifestyle. It's not enough for us to be moral alone. We have to be holy also. And therefore, it says that if we separate ourselves and live a different lifestyle than the non-Jewish world, not the worst of them, the best of them, the most moral, the ones who are going to get a share in the world to come, if we live a different lifestyle, a lifestyle of holiness, then we're God's. We belong to Him. We are His representatives in the world. But if we don't live a life like that, and we live the same moral existence they live, but we don't live a holy existence, then we're in the same group as Nebuchadnezzar. What did Nebuchadnezzar do? He destroyed the temple. He destroyed a temple of wood and stone, and we're destroying the temple of our heart. What? Yeah. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed a temple of wood and stone, and we are destroying the temple of our heart.
The sentence before.
Yeah, that if we separate ourselves from the nations of the world and live that holy existence, then we are God's representatives. We belong to Him. And if not, then we belong to the same group of Nebuchadnezzar, the people who destroyed the temple. We're also destroying a temple, except he destroyed a temple of wood and stone, and we're destroying a temple of our heart. So that is our mission in this world, to live a holy existence. And don't make the mistake to think that that means we're supposed to sit in a corner all day and say Tehillim. It's a nice thing to do, but that's not what it means. Living a holy existence means every aspect of life, every mundane pursuit is done in a way that's holy, not just moral. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, there was a Jewish religious man who lived outside of Boston. His name was Aaron Feuerstein. He owned a textile mill and employed hundreds of workers, most of them not Jewish. His textile mill burnt to the ground. He had no more business. Now, morally, he could have told his workers, I really would love to keep you employed, but I have no more business. So you're going to have to find other employment. When I build my business back, I'd be more than happy to rehire you if you're available, but right now I don't have a business. And it took him months, maybe years, to build back the business. What he did, though, was not drop them from the payroll. He kept everyone on the payroll, not to pay them a salary. He couldn't do that. He told them, you're free to go find other employment, but I'm not going to drop your names from my payroll, so you don't lose your pensions, you don't lose your medical benefits. Right? I'm going to keep all of that up until I build my business back. That's not morality. That's holiness. And it was picked up by every media world over. And it was a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. Here's a religious Jew who acts in a holy way. There must be a God, because this is a godly way to function. So it's not just in the religious aspect of life between man and God, but every aspect of life, political, social, married, economic. A Jew has to act in a way that his conduct in those areas is godly. So he represents God to the world by the way he acts in every aspect of life.
Can there give another example?
Another example? Yeah, but since we have a lot more to do, ask me at the end and I'll give you another example. Okay. How does that work out? How do we know, right, how to function in such a way? So, the Gemara says that this question was asked, the question I'm going to tell you now, to the prophets, to the sages, even to the angels, and no one could answer it until God Himself had to answer the question. Al Meh of the Haaretz, why was Eretz Yisrael lost? Why was Eretz Yisrael destroyed? Why did we go into Golus? And no one can answer the question until God answered the question, Al Ozvam is Torah Si, because they forsook my Torah. So, and the rabbis say it doesn't mean that they forsook the Torah, because they didn't forsake the Torah completely. They still observe the Torah, and they even learn Torah. So it says because they didn't make a bracha before they learned Torah. They failed to make the bracha before they learned Torah. Now this is a very difficult gemara. First of all, it says that the first temple was destroyed because of three major sins: idolatry, immorality, and murder. So that didn't make a difference. But they didn't make a blessing before they learned Torah. That was the main thing. And so what was the question over here? Right? It's obvious why Eretz Yisrael was destroyed, because they were over these terrible sins. So why did you need God to answer the question? And what was God's answer? They didn't make a bracha before they learned. What does it mean? I think it means the following. The Navi complains that we keep the Torah tzav l'tzav, kav l'kav, a mitzvah here, a mitzvah there, a line here, a line there. What's the problem? That's how you keep the Torah. You don't sit in the sukkah, wave estrog and lulav, eat matzah, and blow shofar all at once. Some days you have this mitzvah, some days a different mitzvah. So why is the prophet complain that we keep the Torah a mitzvah here, a mitzvah there, or whatever? The answer, I think, is the following. If I were to ask you, how many things does God want from us? Things to do, things not to do. So you'd probably say 613. But that's just the main categories. There's branches and sub-branches and sub-sub-branches. So there's a heck of a lot of things. Every time you turn around, God wants something else. Eat this, don't eat that. Dress like this, don't dress like that. Say this, don't say that. Think this, don't think that. That's not true. God is one, ultimate one. And therefore, everything about God is one. And therefore, God has only one will for us. And that is, we should be Yirei Shamayim. Mo Hashem Elokecha Shoel Mimach Ki Im LeYira. God only wants us to fear Him. That's all He wants. Hein Yiras Hashem. Hein is uni. One thing. God wants us to be God-fearing people. What does that mean? Not you walk around all day afraid that God's going to zap you with a lightning bolt. God-fearing means basically the following: that everything you do, think, and say, in every aspect of life, every second you're alive, you do, think, and say in a way that reflects the fact that you're aware that you are created by God in His image and have to function accordingly. That's all. That's all it means. That you have that feeling that every second you have to think, speak, and act in a way that represents the fact that you are a divinely created being created in God's image. Now that is so all-encompassing. It includes everything. It's impossible for us to relate to it. And therefore God had to break it down into its components in order for us to be able to relate to it. Those are called mitzvahs. The way I like to illustrate it is the following. Imagine a gigantic light bulb that is so bright and so big that it's impossible to look at. You can't look at it. It's impossible. So you take the light bulb and you encase it in a gigantic globe. And in the globe you cut 613 little windows. Through each little window you can see one small section of the light bulb. The light bulb is God's will that applies to every aspect of life. The mitzvahs are those windows. Every mitzvah opens up a little window to one small section of that will of God. There's only one light bulb. How do you know what the whole light bulb looks like? If you look through all the 613 windows consecutively, you get a composite picture of the light bulb. Those are mitzvahs. Every mitzvah reveals another aspect of God's will that applies not just to that narrow mitzvah, but to your whole life, your values, your standards, your goals, your personality. The mitzvah is a window to God's will, which applies to every aspect of life and every part of life and every second that you're living. And I'll give you two examples. Shabbos. Shabbos is a very narrow mitzvah. It applies to one day a week for 24 hours, 25 hours. That's it. And it has specific narrow laws that apply to it. 39 malachas and so on. But Shabbos is a window to God's will. Meaning, if you fulfill the mitzvah of Shabbos properly, you open a window. Now you're supposed to look into that window and see what is Shabbos supposed to teach me that I can apply to the rest of the week, to my entire life, to my goals, my standards, my values. What is that? One idea is, Shabbos teaches me that even though God created the world, the physical, material world in 6 days, but the goal was beyond this world, a spiritual day called Shabbos, which corresponds to the fact that the physical, material world is not an end in itself, but it's a means to reach a Olam Haba, a spiritual world that comes after this world. That's what you're supposed to learn from Shabbos. So somebody who keeps Shabbos meticulously, but the entire week, his entire focus to earn another dollar, so he's listened to what God said. He's kept the mitzvah. But he hasn't listened into what God said. There's what's called Shmia Likol Hashem, listening to God, that's doing the mitzvah. And then there's Shmia Bikol, listening into what God said, that is applying what you learn from that mitzvah to your entire life, because that's God's will. The mitzvah is a window to the greater will of God that encompasses a person's life. Another example. This, my example, my mother-in-law, Leah Shalom, told me that I should say as often as I can, because someday maybe I will listen to it too. So I'm hoping maybe that's the time, especially my wife is here as a guest in the shir, and I'm sure she'll appreciate the fact that I'm going to say it, because she's hoping I'm going to listen to it too. Rav Shlaga Feivel Mendelovich was the Rosh Yeshiva in Torah Vadas about 85 years ago in America, in New York. And he also was the founder of Torah Mesorah, the day school movement in America. And one of the first day schools out of New York was in Miami. And his student, Rabbi Alexander Gross, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was the principal of that school. And I attended that school, elementary school. And Rabbi Gross told me this story. He said his Rebbe told him that he was invited, Shlaga Feivel was invited, to be the guest of a wealthy gvir for Friday night meal. He wanted this person wanted the covet of having this Rosh Hashiva eat in his home. So the men came home from shul Friday night, and the balabos knocked on his door, opened the door, looked inside, turned white, was ready to faint. So Shlaga Feivel said, I realized there was something not right at the other side of that door. So I was curious, I peeked in. And right away, I saw what was wrong. The house was a mess, the table wasn't set, and the housewife looked like she just came from Mars. He said, I surmise what happened. The poor woman was tired from preparing for Shabbos. So she probably said, while the men were in shul, I think I'll lie down for a few minutes, and I'll get up in plenty of time to put the house in order and set the table, and she didn't. She fell into a deep sleep, and she didn't wake up till they opened the door. So the house was a mess, the table wasn't set, and she was hovering somewhere between this world and some other world. And Rav Shlaga Feivel said, my initial reaction was that this man is very embarrassed. He's going to have to bring me into this mess, and he's embarrassed that I'm going to see what this house looks like. But as things progressed, I saw that didn't bother him. Because he assumed that I would assume that this is not his fault. He wasn't sure. Obviously, it's his wife's fault. You know what bothered him? On the table were the two challahs uncovered. They didn't have a challah cover on them. And the man was afraid that I would think that he didn't know you're supposed to cover the challahs. So in order to make it clear to me that he knew, and this is also his wife's fault, he starts yelling at his wife, you are lazy, incompetent, don't you know you're supposed to cover the challahs? Now, I know that he knows you're supposed to cover the challahs, and this is his wife's fault. Rav Shlaga Feivel said, at that moment, I thought to myself, this is the most absurd thing I ever saw in my life. Why? Because one of the reasons we cover the challahs when we make Kiddush Friday night is because the bracha on bread is more important than the bracha on wine. In the middle of the week, if you'd eat bread and wine, first you'd make a bracha on the bread, then you make a bracha on the wine. But Shabbos, you can't do that. You have to make Kiddush first. So you have to make the bracha on the wine, which is less important, before you eat the bread. So in order not to insult the bread and embarrass it, we cover it. It shouldn't see its embarrassment that you're making the bracha on the wine before it. Now, I don't know. Maybe my wife bakes insensitive challahs. But I never came home from shul, said something not nice to my challahs. They ran off the table, locked themselves in their room until I could appease them and get them out. It happened a few times with my daughters. Never happened with my challahs. Never. Personally, I never saw an embarrassed challah in my life. And if any of you have seen one, I'm sure there's somebody professional that could help you. What does that mean, you're embarrassed the challah? So the simplest idea is that if you condition yourself not to embarrass an inanimate object, you'll never come to embarrass a human being. And here's a man, says Rav Shaga Feivel, embarrassing his wife publicly in order to defend the honor of a piece of bread. It's absurd. That he got the custom, he listened to what God said 100%. That he understood what it's all about, how to apply it to his life, his standards, his values, his personality, zero. That's what the Navi complains. We keep the Torah as a bunch of commands. Do this, don't do that, just a bunch of games. Do's and don'ts. But we don't realize that it's all a manifestation of God's will that applies to every aspect of life, our values, our standards, our goals. And we're supposed to apply what we learn from the mitzvahs to make our life and mold our life to be a Torah life. It's not just doing a bunch of things. It's a lifestyle. It's a way of life. It's standards and values and whatever. That's why the Navi complains. And that's what it means. Here's people who learned Torah, and they kept mitzvahs, yet they also descended to idolatry, immorality, and murder. How could it be? How could people who learned Torah and kept mitzvahs, how could they do these terrible things? Nobody can answer that question. Until God himself said, you know why? Because when they learned Torah, they didn't make a bracha before. What does that mean? What's the bracha before? The first part of the bracha is la'asok b'divrei Torah. It's not enough just to learn Torah and make it, you know, put information in your head. Torah has to be transformation. I saw that once here on a sign on the wall. Right? It has to transform your personality, your way of life. So we make a bracha not just to learn Torah, but to totally immerse ourselves in the Torah. That's one thing. And then the next bracha is Asher Bochar Bonu Mikol Ha'amim. Torah has to make us holy. Torah has to change our entire lifestyle. We represent God. We have to function in a godly way. They failed to make the bracha means they failed to understand that bracha, to put it into practice. So they learned Torah and they kept mitzvahs, but it was just a bunch of things to do and know. And it didn't change their lifestyle. And therefore, they were able to learn Torah, keep mitzvahs, and still be murderers, adulterers, and idolaters. So, that is the mission of the Jewish people, to be holy. And God gave us Eretz Yisrael in order to be able to create that kind of society. Omad vayimodeid Eretz. God measured every land, and he found no land more suitable to the mission of the Jewish people than Eretz Yisrael, and no people more suitable to Eretz Yisrael than the Jewish people. Why? We're a holy people who have a direct relationship with God, and who are supposed to represent God's presence in the world. And Eretz Yisrael is a holy land with a direct relationship with God, where God's presence is supposed to devolve in this world. So we fit each other perfectly. So the place in the world where we are supposed to be able to create a society where every aspect of society is holy, not just moral, our married life, our social life, our economic life, our political life, all should be holy. This is diametrically opposed to the purpose of secular Zionism. Secular Zionism was founded by Herzl in order that the Jewish people should be normal, like everybody else. He felt that anti-Semitism came from Jews not being normal. We live in other people's countries, speak their language, right? Use their economies. We're parasites. So we're not normal. That's why the Goyim hate us. But we have our own country and our own language and our own post office and our own army and our own economy. Then we'd be normal like everybody and they wouldn't hate us any more than they hate each other. They would, what's it called? There'd be no anti-Semitism. And subsequent Zionist thinkers added to that. In order to be really normal like the nations of the world, we need our own criminals and our own perverts too. So today, Baruch Hashem, we have our own country and our own language and our own post office and army and criminals. And we're normal and the Goyim just love us. They don't know what to do for us first. Didn't work. That's not the purpose of Eretz Israel. The purpose of Eretz Israel is the opposite. That we should have our own country and our own language and our own post office and our own army and our own economy. But not that we should be like the nations of the world. That we should have it all in a holy fashion. So we can be the lighthouse of God's presence to the world from Eretz Israel in every aspect of society. Okay, I don't know if we're accomplishing that today, but in one area we are. Politics. When the Goyim see Israeli politics, what do they say? Oh my God. So we bring God to mind through our political... I don't know if that's what God had in mind, but in any case... Now it says in the Torah that three times a year we had to go up to Yerushalayim. Aliyah L'Regel, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. We made a pilgrimage to Yerushalayim, had to be seen in the temple, bring sacrifices. And the Torah tells us the following. There's a problem with that. Because if everybody has to go up to Yerushalayim, the men and the children and the women, everybody goes to spend Yontif in Yerushalayim. So who's going to be guarding the home front? Goyim are going to come and just take it without firing a shot. Nobody's there. You can't even leave soldiers and policemen. They have to be in Yerushalayim too. They also have a mitzvah. So God promises us, Lo yachmod ish esarzecha, no one will covet your land when you go three times a year to Yerushalayim. It's always bothered me. Why does God have to tell us no one will covet the land? Just tell me nobody will take it. I don't care if they covet it or not. Let them want it. Just don't take it. Why did we ever need a promise they won't want your land? Want it. Just prevent them from taking it. So I think the answer is the following. It says, why aren't the hot springs of Tveria in Yerushalayim? Wouldn't it be an honor for Yerushalayim to have the hot springs here, not in Tveria? Why aren't the luscious fruits of the Galil in Yerushalayim, not in the Galil? The Gemara says, because three times a year we were going up to Yerushalayim in a pilgrimage, right, to come face to face with God. God didn't want us to go up to Yerushalayim for a hot bath or for good fruit. He wanted us to go up totally for spiritual purposes. But the hot springs and the good fruit is in the rest of Eretz Israel, which means the following. Three times a year we're supposed to go up to Yerushalayim and learn what it means to be holy. To see the Kohanim and the Levium and the Sanhedrin and the sacrifices and get inspired by the Beis HaMikdash and to know what it means to represent God, what godliness is. And then we're supposed to go back home and apply that holiness to every aspect of life. To make our social life holy and our married life holy and our economic life holy and so on and so on and so on. Not just to be moral, but to be God's representatives to the world. So the purpose of going up to Yerushalayim three times a year is to get your batteries charged, to understand what holiness is so you can apply it to everything in life. So in Yerushalayim itself, the material things didn't exist. It was totally spiritual. But when you went back home, you applied that holiness to the hot springs and to the good fruit, and there you applied the holiness to every mundane thing in life. And you did it in a holy way that's godly. I'll give you another example now. Aside from functioning economically in a holy way, like we said, there's another example I can give you. We have a law that you're not allowed, men and women are not allowed to be alone in a way that immorality could come about. Okay? Even if they're outstanding people or whatever, but you're not allowed to have yichud. Okay? A man and woman who are not married, except for a father and a son, a father and a daughter, or a mother and a son, or grandparents and grandchildren, except aside from that, you're not allowed to be alone, right? Except in certain situations, how many people there are, or where it is, but it's seclusion. One man and one woman are not allowed to be alone, whatever. I'll tell you the background of the story, because it has to do with this uncle who died. on Shavuos of Vitalis a few years ago, who were saying the Shir in his memory. He used to come and spend about a month, a little bit more than a month, after Pesach with us. And I had a house at that point that had three bedrooms, and I had 11 children. So we had one bedroom was my wife and myself, and then 11 children were in two bedrooms. Five girls in one room and six boys in the other. My six boys had triple bunk beds. The one of my kids reminds me that every morning he got up, he hit his head on the ceiling. And this was fine when the kids were little. My two older daughters became teenagers, and they came to my wife and myself, and they said, "We can't live like this. We can't share a room with our bratty sisters, right? We need our own privacy. We need our own space." So I had another house for my svarim. It was full of svarim, but it had two bedrooms there. So they said, "We would like to move into your study," which was opposite our house, "and each one can have their own room. We can decorate it. We can be like young ladies." So we allowed that. But when my uncle came to stay, there was no place for him to stay in the house. He always stayed in one room in the study. So I told my daughters, "You're going to have to move back into the house for the time that he's here, because you're not allowed to be alone with him in that house." So they said, "No, we thought of that. We're going to both move into one room, and he can stay in the other room. And everything is fine." I said, "No, it's not fine, because you can't be alone in that house with him." He said, "Tati, it's ridiculous. He's an old uncle who was our babysitter. He's old and sick, right? If you're afraid that we're going to initiate anything, we promise you, we're not interested. And if we're afraid he's going to initiate anything, what can he initiate? He's an old, sick man. So there's no problem. We'll stay in our room, he stays in his room, everything will be kosher v'yosher." So I said, "I'm sorry, but can't be." And I explained to them that you're right. Morally speaking, there's nothing immoral about the two of you staying in one room and him in another room. The chances of anything wrong happening are like almost nil. But we have a responsibility to be more than moral. We have to be holy. And that's not holy. It's not holy. It's moral, but it's not holy. So that's another example. In any case, so three times a year, we're supposed to go up to Yerushalayim and learn how to be holy and then apply it to every aspect of life. The Ibn Ezra asks, how could the Torah prohibit you from coveting what somebody else has? If you see it, you want it. How could you control the emotion? Says the Ibn Ezra, I'll tell you how you can control the emotion. People are jealous, covet only what they think is within their realm. But something that's totally out of their realm, people aren't jealous of. There's no reason to be jealous. You know that it's not something that's within your realm. He gives an example. A peasant is never jealous of the king's daughter, right, to marry the king's daughter. It's not something that he covets, that he wants, because he knows it's not possible. I like to give a different example, because I don't know too many king's daughters or what's called kings, for that matter, or peasants. I'll give the following example. You have a doctor and a shoemaker who are neighbors. The doctor gets the state-of-the-art ultrasound equipment, and the shoemaker gets the state-of-the-art sewing machine. Do you think the doctor is going to be jealous of the shoemaker's sewing machine? Of course not. What does he need sewing machines for? If he sews up his patient's sewing machine, he's not going to be a doctor too long. Do you think that the shoemaker is going to be jealous of the doctor's ultrasound equipment? Of course not. What does he need it for? He knows what's in his shoes, feet. Right? He doesn't need ultrasound. But let another doctor get a better machine, or another shoemaker get a better sewing machine, the doctor will be jealous of the other doctor and the shoemaker of the other shoemaker. But something that's out of your realm completely, you're not jealous of. Therefore, the Torah says the following. If three times a year you go to Yerushalayim and you learn what it means to be holy, and you come back and you live a holy existence in every aspect of life, like you're supposed to, and Eretz Yisrael becomes a place of holiness, then the Goyim won't want your land, because they'll realize it's not their realm. They don't want to be holy like that. Your holiness, for sure. Even if they claim that they want holiness, it's surely not your idea of what holiness is. They have a different idea of what holiness is. Blowing yourself up to smithereens or whatever, right? But that's not our idea of holiness. So, if you live a holy existence, you go three times a year to Yerushalayim, and you come back and apply that holiness to every aspect of life, I promise you the goyim won't want your land, because they'll see it's not for them. It's a different realm. But if you live the same existence they live, the same secular existence, then why shouldn't they want your land? It's good for you secularly, why shouldn't it be good for them secularly? That's what the Torah promises us. So the purpose of Yerushalayim is to prompt us, to mentor us in what holiness is, so we can apply it to every aspect of life throughout Eretz Yisrael and live our mission of being God's representatives to the world in every aspect of life. And therefore, the things that happen on the 17th of Tammuz, in addition to the fact that the Goyim broke through the walls of Yerushalayim, if we don't know how to use Yerushalayim properly in order to create a society that's holy, then we don't deserve it. Then the Goyim come in and they breach the walls and we don't have that holiness anymore. And what else happened on that day? Everything that fits that same thing. Moshe Rabbeinu broke the luchos. You know why? Because he came down with the Torah and the people were serving a golden calf. Moshe was afraid, I think the Kutzk Rebbe says, that the people would take the luchos and dance around the eagle with the luchos. They think you could have Torah and you could have the eagle too. Torah doesn't mean a different lifestyle. It just means you have a lot of things to do. So we can use the Torah, dance around the eagle. And Moshe wanted to show them, you can't. It's either you have the Torah or you have the eagle. You can't have both. It's a different lifestyle. It's a different way of living. The same thing, you can't put an idol in the Holy of Holies. It's a contradiction. That's what happened on Shavuot Batamos. And if you do that, you're burning the Torah. You basically can't have the Torah if it doesn't apply, it doesn't transform your lifestyle. If it doesn't, then it's not the Torah. Then it's an idol in the Holy of Holies. Then you're burning the Torah. And that's the idea of the Korban HaTamid. The daily sacrifice showed that on every level, every day, right? No, you don't need a special day. You don't need Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkos. Every single day, twice a day, a person is supposed to get close to God, bring two sacrifices to represent that every mundane, daily routine of life has to be holy. That stopped on Shavuos Batamos. Shavuos Batamos, the day that we learned in a very tragic way, we were jolted to know that if you don't take the Torah and internalize it, and change your life because of it, and live a holy lifestyle, then you don't have the Torah. So all the things, the five things that happen on Shavuos Batamos represent this concept. And therefore, if we want Shavuos Batamos to be changed into a yontif, which it will be, maybe even today, who knows, right? If you want it to change into a yontif, then we have to learn the lesson. And we have to be able to keep the Torah not just as a bunch of commands, not just a game, but to make it change our lifestyle, change our values and standards, and they apply to every mundane thing of life. And in that way, we will need Yerushalayim to be the place that we'll be able to ascend three times a year and learn how to be holy, and then go back to wherever we live in Eretz Yisrael, because all Jews will be in Eretz Yisrael, and apply it to every mundane, every aspect, every regiment of life, that will live in a way that we are a holy people. Mamleches Kohanim. We will be the empire of representatives of God to the world by living a holy existence in every aspect of life, and then we'll be fulfilling our purpose. We'll be bringing out the purpose of Eretz Yisrael and the purpose of Yerushalayim and the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash, which Amir Tzashem will be rebuilt soon in our days.
Amen.